I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Wendy Murphy. She's the director of the Women's and Children's Advocacy Project at New England Law /Boston, where she also teaches sexual violence law. In addition, she's an impact litigator specializing in the constitutional and civil rights of abused women and children. So first off, thank you for your work in the world, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Oh, I'm so glad to be here, Derek. Thanks for having me.
So our original email discussion about this interview started with, I wanted to do an interview about the prevalence of rape on college campuses, and that is something that you have worked on. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Oh, sure. My work with regard to the harms women endure in college dates back to really the early 90s, when I was a prosecutor before that, specializing in sex crimes. And when I left the DA's office, I started representing victims in civil cases. And a young girl and her mom came to me one day and said that a teacher was openly calling this girl a dyke and a ditz and a flake and a dumb blonde in front of all the other kids. And wasn't there a law against this? And so, you know, I did research, still a pretty young lawyer. I did a little bit of research and I happened upon Title IX and I read it and it said, no person in the United States shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. In a nutshell, what that means is that Title IX prohibits sex discrimination in education. I almost fell off my chair because I thought, whoa, somebody told me that Title IX was only about sports. And that's what I learned as a girl growing up and going through high school and so forth. I didn't even learn about Title IX in law school, much less college. Boy, did I get ripped off, because I was taught that Title IX was just a sports equity rule.
Wait a second. Here I am, they don't reading. Teach Title IX in law school?
They don't teach Title IX. They don't teach the Equal Rights Amendment. I mean, it's incredible how little is taught from K to 12 and beyond about women's equality, women's civil rights, the fact that women are still not equal citizens under the Constitution in America. Unlike almost 170 countries around the world, we are really the only advanced nation, the only industrialized Western nation, where women are explicitly second-class citizens under the Constitution. And so to some extent, not teaching about Title IX and not teaching about the Equal Rights Amendment is, I think, contributing to the fact that we haven't made much progress, because women don't really fight for their rights unless they know they don't have them. And frankly, we've been snookered in so many different ways. And Title IX is just one of them. So, you know, in the early 90s, when I see in the law books that I was not taught correctly about what Title IX is, I did an awful lot of work becoming educated about it. And also, I decided at that moment in time, I'm going to do everything in my power as an attorney to make this better known, to teach the public, to do, you know, high profile cases if I can, to try to shine a light on this, to tell all girls and women around the country that this is important. This is an anti-discrimination law. This is a civil rights law. This is not about sports. And it doesn't mean that it doesn't have any application to sports equity, but that's not really what it is. It doesn't say anything about sports. And, you know, the fact that we've been propagandized to understand it as a sports equity law, to me, was just scandalous. So I started looking around and, you know, kind of searching for a good test case so that I could elevate this issue, elevate this truth. And well, let me say, as an aside, I was able to file a complaint with the Office for Civil Rights on behalf of that young woman, and the teacher got in trouble and the behavior stopped. So that was a good result in that case. But, you know, moving on to kind of the bigger picture and trying to think about a way to use my knowledge to help others become enlightened. It took a few years, but I finally found a good case when I was a visiting scholar at Harvard Law School studying, not coincidentally, or I should say, yeah, I guess we're not coincidentally, the status of women in the criminal justice system in their capacity as victims, which really isn't studied very much or hadn't been back then. So this was 2002. I was doing my research and work there. And the students came to me. They were very angry in the undergraduate school. They said that Harvard, the undergraduate college, had just passed a policy, adopted a new policy requiring only victims of sexual assault on campus to produce independent corroboration as a prerequisite to the school doing anything at all to deal with any report of sexual assault. And they were angry because, of course, that was going to make it much harder for them to report and come forward and expect any kind of meaningful action by the school. And they didn't know what to do. So that was my perfect test case, because I said, this is it. I am very excited to represent you. I'm not going to charge you. We're going to file a complaint with the federal government, the Office for Civil Rights at the Department of Education, and we're going to argue that this is explicit sex discrimination. And of course, they all said what everyone says, well, what law stands for that principle? And I said, Title IX. And they all said, well, we thought Title IX was something to do with sports. And I said, I understand that, but no, it's an anti-sex discrimination, civil rights law. And we view that Harvard is violating your civil rights by subjecting based harm to different and worse treatment by requiring corroboration as a prerequisite to redress on campus. And none of them wanted to volunteer their names to be the plaintiff, if you will, in the case, because of course they were all very concerned legitimately about retaliation. So I ended up filing with the office in Boston, the Office for Civil Rights at the Department of Education, using an anonymous student's name and using my own name, because I said, I'm a member of the class of people affected. This is a class-based civil rights law, and I'm filing on behalf of the class. We had no expectation that this would be successful because no one had ever done this before. And lo and behold, not only did the OCR in Boston open an investigation, they opened an investigation, even though we didn't have a victim of sexual assault disrespected under the policy. We said, we're not going to wait around for Harvard to deny redress to a victim on the grounds that she didn't have a videotape. So we just proceeded preemptively and asked the Office for Civil Rights to kind of injunction forbidding Harvard to apply that new rule to anybody on the grounds that they were violating Title IX and discriminating against women. And it took us about 6 months, which is the typical investigative period for OCR to resolve a case like this. And lo and behold, again, surprisingly, as we did not expect to prevail, simply because it was Harvard. I mean, they're very influential. We thought at some point there would be a political influence brought to bear and we would not prevail. But we did. Harvard was forced to rescind the policy, and the case made enough headlines that people around the country were paying attention, and students started to rise up. I started to help them remotely, because what the other thing that this case really helped to do was to teach students that they, number one, they didn't have to wait to be sexually assaulted before they could challenge their school's policies, which was wonderful, because often if you're traumatized by sexual assault, the last thing you're thinking about is taking on your school in a federal complaint agency complaint context. You got enough to deal with your suffering. So this was a new, really important development in Title IX law, in the sense that students could now, without waiting until a policy was applied to a person on campus, they could just file, they could read the policies at their own campuses, whether they were discriminatory, and file a complaint and fix them. It was really a kind of a repair process that started to happen. And I wrote a law review article about my victory against Harvard, which also helped to elevate the public's understanding. And really, that was the first time. So that was 2002, resolved in 2003. That was the first time that the public understood the connection between Title IX and violence against women, and sexual assault in particular. Prior to that, there really had been no public understanding. So that was a really wonderful, revolutionary moment almost. And interestingly, though, back then, the numbers of sexual assaults on college campuses were lower. They were lower for a lot of reasons, and not least of which is the fact that the internet hadn't really bubbled up yet to the point where students had ready access to pornography and violent pornography, and just the market for pornography changed so dramatically since that time that, and I think there's a significant causal connection between what young people see on their phones or laptops and how they act with each other on college campuses, that I think that's a big explanation for why the numbers have gone up so much. But the other problem is that there wasn't a lot of reporting on college campuses because students didn't understand that schools had an obligation to do something about sexual assault when it happens on campus. They weren't learning on campus that sexual assault, like other forms of sex-based harm and gender-based harm, were in fact covered by civil rights laws, which mandate that schools take effective steps to stop it from recurring, not only against individual victims, but against the class of people affected. So on college campuses back then, even though Title IX had been in place since 1972, students were taught to think about any kind of violence against women as covered by civil rights. So they weren't reporting it on campuses, and that created an invisibility problem. And that was an enormous problem. It's still a pretty big problem. You know, if something doesn't get reported, it doesn't count. And it kind of gives schools a pass for all the wrong reasons. It just doesn't make it into the school's responsibilities. The plate of responsibilities that they deal with regard to civil rights was always pretty good on issues like racism, racial assaults, you know, ethnic assaults, origin, religion. If any of those things happened on college campuses, which, by the way, are covered by the exact same civil rights laws, they're co-equal civil rights laws, and schools were doing the right thing under Title VI, which covers race and national origin and so forth, and they weren't doing the right thing under Title IX. They were just basically ignoring the fact that Title IX covered violence against women, which is a little absurd when you think about it, because when civil rights laws were first passed back in the early 60s, you know, we all have seen the pictures of Black children in the South going to school for the first time with white children. And they were surrounded by armed guards because everybody knew that the kind of violence a little Black child might suffer when going to school would be serious and protected, and, you know, we might even need weapons to protect them. So everybody knew that violence against a person based on race was certainly covered by civil rights laws, and for reasons I still find perplexing, if not scandalous, we didn't make a connection between violence against women and civil rights laws. And a big reason for that is that Title IX was propagandized as a sports equity law, so we just didn't connect the dots as a collective. You know, intellectually, we said violence is different. It's not a civil rights issue. And again, that started to change after I won that landmark case against Harvard in 2002. Move ahead quickly. In some ways, in part because students started to understand their rights better, they started to assert them on campus, and students started to say, hey, you know, I was sexually assaulted. Now you have to take effective steps to stop this from recurring. You have to deal with this under Title IX, which requires all sorts of things for schools to do, investigations, redress grievance proceedings, and so forth. As women started to rise up and demand that schools comply with federal civil rights laws, the schools started to fight back a little bit. And I'm skipping ahead a little bit, but that's partly why we're landing in this mess with Betsy DeVos, the current Secretary of Education. She's really taking us to a new low, if you will, on Title IX. I mean, I shake my head and think, bring back sports equity. I'd rather be misled a little than have the law get worse. And yet Betsy DeVos is, in fact, poised right now to pass new regulations that will explicitly allow schools to subject sex-based harm, such as sexual assault, to different and worse treatment compared to race and national origin, which has never been the law in the history of the country. To the extent sex was included in civil rights laws, which again, for Title IX purposes, started in 1972, we're talking about almost 50 years ago, women finally got the equality under civil rights laws to which they had been entitled years earlier, but they didn't get it. They finally got this equal treatment guarantee with the enactment of Title IX, and yet it just wasn't enforced. And so, you know, finally we figure it out. Here we are 50 years later. We're finally saying, great, we're the same. We're equal. Sex is the same category type on campus as race and national origin, and we want our equal treatment on campus. And boom, as women rose up and started to demand equal treatment as they were entitled to 50 years ago, schools pushed back, and that's what we're seeing now with Betsy DeVos. It literally pushing, with the support of higher ed, I might add, they're literally pushing this change in Title IX regulations that will explicitly give schools the authority to do what they've been doing wrong for 50 years, subject sex-based harm, including sexual assault, to different and worse treatment for the first time in history. So I'm, you know, beside myself that we could go backwards after 50 years. But a big part of the problem is that some of the laws that are being proposed are so heavily lobbied. They're being promoted so heavily by special interests and moneyed interests that there's really nothing students can do. They don't have a lot of political or financial power to fight back. And then the other thing is they're being misled to believe that some of these things we're watching are good for them. And that's a common problem in feminism generally. I mean, there are lots and lots of examples that I've seen in my life where women are angry about something that's happening to them that's unfair or unjust, or they're being treated unequally, and some lawmaker on a white horse shows up to offer a solution, and they sign up for it and say, thank you very much, this is terrific, and they don't understand they've actually just supported a law to cause them to suffer more, that, you know, they've supported a law that's kind of a wolf in sheep's clothing. It looks nice on the outside, but it's really designed, usually through the power of legal terminology and language they don't understand as a term of art, that they've just signed up for something that's going to have unintended consequences, unintended from their perspective, quite intended, if you ask me, from the lawmaker's perspective. But nonetheless, here we are, and it should be no surprise to anybody that we now have nobody disputes this, by the way. We now have numbers with regard to sexual assaults that are climbing and climbing and climbing, even in the aftermath of Me Too and Time's Up and all this kind of silly stuff that we're hearing about from lawmakers. Oh, I'm going to pass a law to, make sure that you get free counseling on campus, which, by the way, does not stop rape. Let's be clear. It does, however, silence victims. You know, when victims are told on campus, you've been raped, we're going to send you down the hall to a counselor. What they don't understand is that counselor works for the university. Even if they work off campus, they're usually in bed with the university. They're often under pressure to dissuade the victim from reporting. Oh, put this behind you. Focus on your studies. Don't file a report. Don't call the police. And, you know, victims are very vulnerable. They're very vulnerable at that time, and they don't feel strong. They're easily persuaded to do nothing, to put it behind them and to stay silent. And as a result of that, which looks good, right, they're getting free counseling, but as a result of that free counseling process, we're seeing much lower rates of reporting and, not surprisingly, higher incidence rates. Last year, well, a couple of years ago, a colleague of mine in Oregon did a study. She's a researcher there as well, but she did a study and came up with approximately 1 in 3 women are sex assault on campuses during years there. Some schools this past year, again, this is only individual schools, and, you know, you can't really extrapolate from that fairly, but some schools in the past year have numbers as high as 1 in 2 women being sexually assaulted during college. If you do even if you use the lowest number, which is somewhere between 1 in 4 and 1 in 5 girls and young women being sexually assaulted during college, you're still talking about well in excess of a million young women being sexually assaulted during their time in college. That's an enormous amount of suffering. Enormous amount, and it's a much higher rate than sexual assault in the real world. And it's a much higher rate, like very much higher rate than even a woman being sexually assaulted military, the hyper-masculine military, which a lot of people find shocking. I don't find shocking at all. It makes perfect sense to me from the perspective that when you join the military is paying money to you. They're investing in you, whether you're female or male. They want you to succeed. They want to get their money back. So they're going to be more interested in protecting you, not getting rid of you. And it's a bit of a more egalitarian environment in that sense, even though the numbers of females are obviously very small compared to the numbers of males, and you'd expect there to be high sexual assault rates for that reason alone. But you compare that with the data we have from colleges, and it makes perfect sense that you're not going to get sexually assaulted in the military as often, because the one of the most common features, if you're looking for factors that cause high rates of sexual assault, the top factors is a sense of entitlement. And boy, is that rampant on college campuses. It is not so rampant in the military, not in the same way. And so it shouldn't surprise us that the schools with the highest numbers of sexual assaults are the Ivies and the elites, you know, Harvard, Princeton, Yale, MIT. These are the schools with the highest numbers year after year because they have the densest populations of entitled males.
So thank you for all that. I have three responses to some things that you've said recently. One of them is that you said a million female students during their time at college, which would roughly go to 250,000 a year. And if we figured that the school year is 250 days, just to make the math easy, that's 1,000 women a day. That's 40 women an hour. That's a lot.
Wow. I've never run the numbers like that. But that is just stunning. And it's shocking. And it's disgusting. And I think, frankly, the number is a little low when there are other people who would put the number even higher than a million a year. I think it's reasonable, but that's what you get. You're supposed to go to college to learn. You're supposed to go to college to become educated and to figure out how to be in the world. And that's what girls are learning. That's what girls and young women are learning when they go to college. They're learning that sexual assault happens, that it's normal, that not much is done about it. And they're becoming acclimated to that feeling about their lives in the real world. So when they enter the real world, they're ready. They are rape ready.
The second thing I was going to say is the rates of rape that you were just talking about. Okay, the first thing that...
Not rape. I have to clarify. Sexual assault, which is not necessarily rape. We have to be fair. Sexual assault could be a touching that's sexual, not necessarily rape, which is penetration.
Okay. The rates of sexual assault that you just listed for women at college are higher than the rates of rape for men in prison. And,
yes.
You know, whenever you have a prison movie, I mean, the first thing that any guy will comment about the prison movie or somebody going to prison, they will make some comment about prison rape. So when it happens to a man, this is something that is remarkable. And when it happens to a woman, this is college.
Well, right. And even in the real world, when men get raped, the punishments for rapists tend to be much higher than when women get raped. The most recent research I'm aware of is a few years old, but it mirrors the research from 30 years before that. The number that people talk about a lot is that 2%, somewhere between 2 and 3% today, but between 2 and 3% over the past 30 years, of rapists spend even one day behind bars.
There's no punishment,
but let's not even just talk about punishment. Here's an issue for me that I think is more paramount than even are we locking people up or whatever punishment anybody wants to impose. For me, it isn't about are we punishing people severely enough. It's how are we punishing them compared to people who commit similar offenses based on race, national origin, and so forth, because equality is important. Beyond everything else, equality is the fact that most offenders will offend again and again. And on college campuses, we've seen this data a lot. There tends to be enormous recidivism. So one offender will do it again and again because he's learned after the first time that it's not something he's likely to get in trouble for. So why not do it again and again? And, you know, this is not to say that most guys are bad guys. It's that the ones who offend really aren't afraid of offending because there are no consequences. So the messaging is really backward. And the exact opposite message is sent when any student commits any kind of offense on campus that's based on race or national origin and so forth. In my in a law review article I wrote recently in the Journal of College and University Law, it's really a book review of a horrible book by Jonathan Krakauer called Missoula. It's only horrible in the sense that he really disrespects women's equality and the equal treatment women are entitled to under Title IX. And it's really bad propaganda in the sense that he misleads the reader to believe that the law is something much different than what it actually is. And so I critiqued it. I was very harsh on him. But in there, I write about the fact that, it's so important to approach this from the perspective of equality and equal treatment because of what students perceive when there is an urgent and effective response to anything on campus. If their perception is, wow, that guy just got expelled and all he did was X, I better not do that. Students see it. They talk about it. It's really powerful. How the school responds is extremely, very powerful. And so the piece I write about in my law review article, the story I write about is about an Indiana student who a few years ago physically hurt a Muslim student on campus. He was expelled in 3 days. 3 days. Nobody said, well, what about his due process rights? Nobody said, wait, there has to be an investigation. Nobody said, oh, come on, you don't want to ruin the guy's life. Nobody said, this is unfair to the guy. No one said that. But if that same guy had committed a sexual assault based on sex or gender against any woman on campus, there's no way he would have been expelled. No way he would have been suspended. And I, based on statistics, there would be a very good chance he wouldn't have faced any punishment at all. So the message on campus is if you offend a Jewish person, a Muslim person, or anybody based on national origin or race, you're gone. You don't even have to physically hurt them. You don't have to rape them. You just have to offend them. And they're gone. And so those kinds of harms don't tend to happen over and over again. Those kinds of harms are very, very low compared to harms against women. The harms against women happen over and over again at extremely high rates because the messaging on campus is violence against women is not entitled to that same kind of gold standard treatment that we apply when we respond to any kind of based on race or national origin. Now, it's not just me saying, hey, I think women ought to be treated the same as race and national origin. That's the law. That's been the law since 1972. And, you know, had there been equal treatment of all the harms women endure since 1972, we would not have seen an escalation in any of the assaults they suffer. We wouldn't see an escalation in violence against women at all on campus because responding effectively and quickly, even if not harshly, but responding effectively and quickly is the thing that stops it from recurring not only to that victim, but to women as a class. And schools have never, ever done that, particularly the elite schools and the Ivy League schools. And here's what the law has mandated. This is really important because it remains the law for race and national origin. And it's still the law for sex and gender, but that's going to change with Betsy DeVos, although lots of people are probably going to sue her if her currently proposed regulations go through, including me. I've already promised to sue her. And frankly, I'm already suing her in Boston federal court for her sub-regulatory guidance that she promulgated in 2017, in the fall of 2017. I sued her for that, saying, you have no authority. You're just an agency head. You don't have any authority to issue a letter, weaken women's rights under Title IX with a letter. Congress can weaken Title IX, but you are not Congress. That's my lawsuit that's currently pending against her in federal court in Boston. But once she puts it up a notch and issues regulations, which are more enforceable than sub-regulatory guidance, once she issues once Betsy DeVos issues regulations which are more enforceable and really have the force of law, which are scheduled to come out at some time the end of this year, she's going to get sued again on the theory not so much that she doesn't have authority to do what she did, but that she can't issue regulations that subvert the purpose of Title IX. And the obvious purpose of Title IX is to guarantee equality and protection against discrimination. And her proposed regulations discriminate against women. So how can you issue regulations that discriminate when the statute under which you get your authority to issue regulations prohibits discrimination? I mean, it's really absurd. It's like using the civil, it would be like the Department of Justice issuing a regulation allowing there to be separate water fountains for Black people, and saying that the authority they cite as support for their ability to issue these sorts of regulatory requirements comes from the Civil Rights Act of 1964. You can't cite the Civil Rights Act as giving you authority as a federal agency to discriminate. It's the most perverse use of anti-discrimination laws, and that's really what Betsy DeVos is currently proposing. So I think she's going to face a lot of legal troubles for what she's doing, even though the proposal might change a little bit between now and when they come out. Any separate or different treatment based on sex is subject to challenge, and she's going to face lawsuits, if she issues regulations that allow schools to treat women differently or separately from national origin, because that's currently prohibited by Congress. If Congress wants to change Title IX and say, we hereby deny women this equal treatment that we promised them in 1972, if Congress wants to do that, they can. They have the power to do that. But good luck if they think they'll ever get reelected. That's one of the reasons we're seeing it being done in this very subversive way. Congress could not politically get away with weakening Title IX, so they're sicking Betsy DeVos, propping up a female, sicking Betsy DeVos on the problem, and doing it at the regulatory level, hoping they can get away with it. I don't think they will get away with it, but it's a really ugly, really politically kind of nasty way to weaken women's rights in a way that they're not even, you know, they're not even really, most women's groups anyway, are not even really understanding, or at least they're not talking about how the real problem here is not what is DeVos proposing to do, but is she proposing to segregate out only sex-based harms such as sexual assault and subject them to second-class treatment? That's where the outrage should be. That's where people should be rising up. That's where women's groups should be angry. Forget the nitty-gritty of what DeVos is proposing in her 80-page document. Complain about and rise up about and have protests about the segregation of sex-based harm, the second-class treatment of sex-based harm, and point out that this is going to wreak havoc on campuses. Campuses are going to have a splitting headache about this, because what if a woman shows up and says, I was sexually assaulted based on my sex and my race? Are schools going to send her skin color down the hall to the gold standard treatment room, where she's going to get redress under civil rights laws, which mandate impartial investigations, prompt and equitable redress, which are critical, right? Those are the basic standards that apply when you have to deal with a civil rights matter on campus. So the skin color of this woman's body is going to get sent down the hall to the gold standard treatment room, and she's going to get an immediate investigation, equitable redress. It's going to be very effective and prompt. And the school's going to have to stop it from recurring, not only to her, but to any students based on race on campus, period. And if they don't do it, they can get in serious trouble. They're going to get sued and so forth. But the vaginal aspects of the woman's assault, the sex and gender-based aspects of that exact same woman's assault, are going to get sent down the hall to the second-class treatment room, where there won't be an impartial investigation. There won't be equitable redress. She won't be entitled to a prompt hearing. She won't be entitled to grievance under those standards. And drag it out until she graduates. Never die, never prevent him from doing it again. And they won't take, quote unquote, effective steps to stop it from recurring, because that's not what DeVos is going to require. Now, how's a school going to do that? How will a school separate one woman's reported sexual assault into two different procedural procedural events? How are they going to do that? And don't you think we're talking about such an obvious act of discrimination that a woman who is assaulted based on race, national origin, sex, of course she's going to report it as an incident based on race or national origin. She's not even going to report it as a sex-based offense, because she doesn't want to risk being sent down the hall to the second-class treatment room. And guess what that's going to do? And this is really the genius, the malicious genius of the people trying to make this happen. That's going to create invisibility all over again. The first era of invisibility was, let's teach girls and women that Title IX only covers sports. That worked very well for decades to create invisibility around the suffering women were enduring in the form of assault, sexual assault, dating abuse, whatever you want to call it. Any form of sex-based harm and gender-based harm that was going on for decades was invisible because we propagandized Title IX as a sports equity rule. Now that we know it's an anti-discrimination law, which of course covers the most severe expression of discrimination, violence, we're suddenly moving in the opposite direction and preparing to explicitly separate out sex-based harm and subjected to second-class treatment. You know, I'm not sure how that's going to work. I think it's going to wreak havoc. I think it's going to make students crazy. I think they're going to start, well, in terms of emphasizing the invisibility problem, if women are going to choose to identify in terms of the suffering as Black or Jewish, whatever, and not report that they suffered sex-based harm, we have to look at how this is going to recreate that invisibility problem that we saw when Title IX was propagandized as a sports equity rule, and understand that this is going to stop women from categorizing their suffering as sex-based, which then gives schools permission not to report any sex-based harm. Lo and behold, we're going to see dramatically lower numbers, and those numbers are going to be fake. Not that we have lower incidence rates, but we had almost no reporting of the harm as sex-based. Women suffering becomes invisible in a whole new way all over again.
A couple of things. This reminds me, one is that this reminds me of back in, I think, 2001 when I was writing Cultural Make-Believe. At that point, I don't know if it's changed since, but at that point, hate crime laws were such that if a man raped a woman because she was African-American, or if he raped her because she was a lesbian, or if he raped her because she was from a certain country, that could be considered a hate crime. But if he raped her because she was a woman, that was not considered a hate crime. And I called the FBI about that, and I was talking to somebody there, and the person I was talking to said, well, that's because if he rapes her because she's a woman, that's just about sex.
Completely wrong.
So that actually wrong. I'm sorry, what?
That's wrong and stupid. And by the way, the law has changed since then. So federal hate crimes laws now do cover sex and gender, but you're right to have pointed that out, and good for you. Most people don't even notice. However, it so happens that in half the states, maybe even more, but around half the states, sex and gender are not covered by state hate crimes laws. And that's important because most prosecutions of violence against women are done at the state level, not the federal level. And you might be shocked to hear this, but notoriously, Massachusetts refuses to add sex and gender to its hate crimes law, even though it perceives itself as one of the most progressive states and loves to boast about how progressive it is on women's issues. It's absolutely behind the times on issues of violence against women in many, many ways. And this is one that I've really been working hard on for a long time. They have excluded sex, gender from the state hate crimes law, which is exactly as you put it, Derek. If a woman is raped based on race, national origin, what have you, that is a hate crime. But if she's raped based on sex or gender, it's not. It's just not covered. And even though it might not matter so much if you prosecute someone for rape versus rape plus a hate crime, it matters when you have a law on the books that covers every category except women and girls. It's really important to emphasize that when we passively accept and read about and learn about these laws and just kind of take them in, we have to understand the harm it does to our psyche and to our sense of how women, you know, what women's roles are in the world, that we're reading a law that has everybody's category there except women. And, you know, it kind of creates in our software this idea that it's normal that women are not equal. It's normal that women are second class because it seems to pop up all the time in our laws when we read them. Women are missing. Women are missing. Women are missing. Well, interestingly, in 2012 in Massachusetts is when transgender was added to the Massachusetts hate crimes law. And at that time, obviously, people said, you know, we're adding transgender and I think people are going to notice that we're skipping over gender and sex. And people did notice, and it was quashed. People really, you know, really fiercely worked against adding sex and gender. So it's come up again, time and time again, I should say, over the years, with some of the politicians who spearheaded adding transgender in 2012. And one of them was Maura Healey, our current attorney general, who was, I believe at the time, the head of the civil rights division at the attorney general's office. She's now, of course, in charge of the office. So she's in an even more influential position to be able to fix this obvious problem. And she won't. She's been confronted multiple times by me and others. Why did you push so hard to add transgender to the state hate crimes law and not include gender or sex or both? What the hell? What is your problem with this? Why wouldn't you do this? Why would you ignore an entire class of people while holding yourself out as an advocate for women and somebody women should vote for because you're such a women's candidate? You're not a women's candidate if you see fit to support the enactment of any law that explicitly excludes women from equal protection of the law. She will not answer the question. She just refuses. And the reason it's particularly disturbing that she refuses, as does the governor. And, you know, I've asked so many people over the years publicly, including the governor, Baker, you know, do you think we should add sex and gender to the hate crimes law? And privately, they say yes. Publicly, don't do it. And I'm not sure why that is. There are lots of prosecutors who could support it but won't. And police in Massachusetts, law enforcement officials are frustrated because the number one problem in their communities by far is violence against women. From domestic violence to sexual assault, that is the number one interpersonal violence problem they deal with. You know, they may have drug cases that are problematic, but the number one form of violence they deal with is violence against women. And they're the ones who have, you know, talked about, why is this not a hate crime? The numbers are so high. If we could treat it as a priority crime, I think the numbers down. But you know, we got the revolving door problem at the courthouse mixed with this idea that women being targeted for violence, targeted for harm as a bias offense because of who they are in society doesn't seem to resonate, doesn't seem to matter. Well, of course the violence is going to escalate. You've just declared women second-class citizens. Why wouldn't violence escalate? The studies, I could cite study after study after study, global studies that show second-class citizens, second-class people always, always suffer disproportionately high rates of violence and abuse. So, you know, you declare a person a second-class citizen and subject them to second-class treatment and protection of the law, of course they're going to suffer more violence and abuse. And I don't care how many counseling and education programs you throw at this, that doesn't work. It absolutely doesn't work. Schools in this country are spending a fortune trying to teach students, all the way through the college, trying to teach people not to rape, not to hurt women, not to, you know, engage in violence and abuse. None of it works. The studies over and over and over again show that you cannot use training and education to stop this. You have to use the guarantee of equal treatment. You have to teach the value of equality. You have to convey the idea that no one should be subjected to harm, because the space between equality and inequality is where violence against women happens with impunity under the law. That's a fact. And it will never stop, ever stop, so long as women are subjected to different and worse treatment, something that we're now about to watch become codified in federal law with the help of Betsy DeVos, hasn't been a reality in the past. Even though we didn't know our rights, it was a mandate that we be treated equally. Now it's about to become a federal mandate that we be treated as second-class citizens. And I'm not surprised to see this as well, but even some state legislatures are now moving toward adopting at the state law level statutes that will similarly give schools permission to segregate out only sex-based harm, such as sexual assault and dating abuse, and subject it to different and worse treatment compared to harm based on race and national origin. I was just at the Massachusetts State House last week testifying against a bill that was being heard in front of the Committee on Higher Education, the Joint Committee on Higher Education. They were prepared to consider a proposed bill supported by higher education that will completely change the law in Massachusetts. Right now, under state law, schools may not treat sex-based harm differently than race-based harm. Under the proposed law that they just heard last week, schools will have explicit permission to segregate out only sex-based harm subjected to different and worse treatment compared to race-based harm. That's going to explode incidence rates under state law and federal law. You know, when the federal law was moving in the wrong direction, a lot of lawyers I know around the country said, we're going to give up on filing lawsuits under Title IX. We're going to give up filing complaints with the Office for Civil Rights at the Federal Department of Education. We're going to move toward relying on state law and file complaints with the State Department of Education, because state law is so good. Women are equal under state law. You know, civil rights for women are in education are fully equal, on par with race and national origin under state law. Let's rely on state law and forget Betsy DeVos, forget federal law. Well, guess what happened? State lawmakers started to take up similar proposals to weaken girls and women's rights under state law. It's already passed in New York. Bills have passed in other states and have been proposed in many other states. And this is just a nightmare in Massachusetts. Recently heard, which means it's on its way to be law, most of the students who testified in favor of it have no clue what they're doing. They don't understand that they are asking the legislature to support and enact a bill that will allow schools to mistreat them. They were up there saying, I was raped in college, please pass this law. It's going to help me, and it's going to help my college, my friends, and helps. And I want to hold schools accountable, and please pass this law. It's a great thing. Thank you. And, you know, we're talking about 19, 20-year-old kids who were told to go testify in support of this bill because the bill was a great idea. They have no clue. They're not sophisticated enough. They don't understand the language of the bill. They don't understand the wording. They don't understand that they're being denied impartial investigations. They're being denied prompt and equitable redress. They're being denied equal treatment on par with race and national origin. They don't understand. It's so bad. It's so bad what's going on in our legislatures at the state and federal level, and in our agencies like Betsy DeVos at the Department of Education, really just force feeding us these horrific bills that will subjugate women under civil rights laws with particular regard to education for the first time in history. And there is no better, there is no, look, If you're going to ruin women's rights, don't ruin them in education. Education is a special place where young people need to learn others are equal, that all are equal, that there is nobody who, because of who they are in society, should be treated as a second-class citizen. The lessons kids learn matter. They carry them into life. And we are about to start training students, training them to see women as second-class people for the first time since 1972.
Well, thank you so much for all that. I think that's incredibly important analysis. And unfortunately, we're out of time. And I would like to thank you so much for your work in the world, and thank you for being on the program. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Wendy Murphy. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.